Good morning, everybody. It is September 13th, 2021. This is the ADK Homeroom, your home away from homeroom, and I am your teacher in exile, your host, Frank. I hope that you had as great a weekend as we did. We had a little festival here in our small town nestled in the heart of the Adirondacks. We had ribs, we had cake, we had breads, we had homemade goods, potluck of every kind, as long as it was good luck. We had bouncy houses, we had dunk tanks, we had those long boppers where you try to knock the other guy off the little pedestal into the bouncy cushion. Oh, it was a good weekend. Good weekend. We had soccer. I hope you had a wonderful time too. We're going to get into it as usual. We have 20 to 30 minutes of commentary on current events, and then we have 20 to 30 minutes of commentary on a deep dive issue. We're going to continue with some amazing things, possibly, hopefully, in humanity's future. What is possible for us? What are some unseen benefits that may be available to us on the horizon if we work hard and we structure our civilization society right? What could we have? Let's start off, as always, with the science fact of the day. Your slogan is longer, better, factor, stronger. Da, 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 da. I think you see a theme over the last few slogans for the science fact of the day. Today's fact of the day is Newton's great synthesis. This is the gravitational synthesis, the great synthesis. Second only to one other idea in changing philosophical thought, religious thought, everything about human academic intellectual inquiry. Obviously, science and history, all sorts of art. What was the other idea that was possibly even greater than the great synthesis, that was most influential across different disciplines, most influential scientific idea of all time? Got to be evolution, right? Middle of the 19th century, evolution really impacted everything. Well, I'll tell you, if evolution, it hit art too, right? If it Whitman and poetry, if it impacted things like Twain with his pessimism later in life, perhaps, well, I'll tell you what, then the great synthesis, it overshadowed, it caught up to Pope. It even influenced the romantics like Keats, who wrestled against it. Apparently Keats had a toast where he liked to toast to Newton and confusion to mathematics. Oh, poor Keats. Keats, Mozart, and Poe, the top three intellectuals we lost too soon, or artists, I should say. So what was the great synthesis? Why do people say, have you ever thought about this? A lot of people used to ask me about this in my classroom. They would say, how come people say Isaac Newton invented gravity or discovered gravity? He had an apple fall on his head. He discovered gravity. That doesn't make any sense. Why do we need genius to discover gravity? Look, I dropped my Pepsi-free bottle right here. It falls down to the ground. You do not need one of the top three mathematicians and top three physicists of all time to realize that gravity pulls things toward the center of the Earth. Yeah, that's true. So it's not that Newton discovered gravity in the sense that he discovered things fall toward the center of the Earth. What Newton did is he discovered that the same gravity that acts to pull things down towards the center of the Earth is also the gravity that holds planets in motion around the sun, holds the moon in orbit around the Earth. Almost impossible to overstate the importance of this idea. He synthesized, he brought together the heavens and the Earth. Again, you might see a little similarity between this idea and the slogan for the science fact of the day and what we've been talking about with that. So he showed people, he sort of completed the work that Copernicus and Galileo had begun with showing that Earth doesn't have any specialized place in the universe. The heavens don't have any specialized, special privileged place in the universe. He was just showing that the heavens and the Earth both obey relatively simple physical laws that can be understood by men. They can be used to predict things by man. They can be used to engineer things by man, right? Sir Francis Bacon said, nature to be commanded must be obeyed. Well, Newton showed us how we are obeying it, what we are doing. And he really, with this great synthesis, he changed how people thought about their place in the world. This was, of course, towards the end of the 17th century, late 1600s, and we were just leading into this Enlightenment time when people were going to re-question everything. Remember, in All Saints Day, you had that great earthquake in Lisbon that helped people rethink their place, man's place. You had God the Clockmaker coming out. You had deism. And the Great Synthesis really sort of helped kick things off. Interestingly enough, right around the time of the Salem witch trials in the United States. Well, they weren't the United States then, of course, but in North America. And we still operate on this principle, right? That the laws of physics are the same in the heavens as they are in Earth. Have we ever been out there to test them? Well, not really. Voyager 1, Voyager 2 are outside of the solar system now. Good job to V'ger. But nothing else. We don't really have anything else out there. And Voyager 1, Voyager 2 really certainly aren't tested designed to test this idea that we just have assumed is true and has worked out as true and has given us amazing scientific advances. But we've never gone out there to test. And we do have some mysteries in space, right? Physics is in the nightmare scenario right now, as many call it, because we have huge fundamental mysteries like dark energy, and dark matter, of course, still eludes us also. And we do not have a whole lot of good evidence, in some cases, not much evidence at all, to investigate, to help us shed some light, to elucidate these mysteries. We just don't. So possibly it could be that maybe the laws of physics do operate different in certain places, but we don't have any evidence for that, so most of the time we don't really work on that principle. We don't really assume that's true and then go from there, although there is such a thing as MOND, modified Newtonian dynamics, which seeks to explain things like dark energy based on modifying Newton's laws. Newton's laws, of course, already corrected by Einstein. But if you do want to read some fascinating novels about a universe where physical laws operate differently in different places, I recommend to you, of course, Werner Vinge's great couplet of novels from the 1990s. Both of them won the Hugo Award. A Deepness in the Sky is the prequel, really, and then A Fire Upon the Deep came first. And Fire Upon the Deep especially talks about it, and it posits this idea that the speed of light is different in different regions of the galaxy. And of course, that leads to some far-reaching and deeply consequential civilizational impacts there. Oh, the Hugo Award. Oh, Werner Vinge won it twice there. Great job by him. What has become of the Hugo Award? One out of the last 18 nominees, male. And then you go back, look, just to make sure that is historically an anomaly. And it pretty much is. If you look at the first 30 years or so, 33 years maybe, of the Hugo Award, only three of the nominees were female. So, yeah, really lower rate now than at the beginning. Very interesting what's happened with the Hugo Award. Let's get into it. Let's get into the news. The biggest piece of the news, of course, right now is still this vaccine mandate. Talked about it briefly on Friday. Joe Biden came out, and Joe Biden, our president here in the United States, says that every employer with 100 employees or more will have to fire their workers. Must fire their workers. That is a strong word, isn't it? Must, if the workers are not vaccinated or if they do not submit to weekly testing. And of course, also in addition to that, any worker at any health facility that receives Medicare or Medicaid funding must be vaccinated. Well, Robbie Sove, my fellow Wolverine, you might know him from Reason Magazine and Reason.com. He had a great op-ed in the New York Times about this over the weekend. Congrats to Robbie on getting in the New York Times. Well done, buddy. So everybody's talking about two Supreme Court precedents in relation to this vaccine mandate. Does the government have the power? Should the government have the power, the federal government have the power to do this? Will it stand up in court against the inevitable challenges? These two precedents that people are talking about are Jacobson in 1905 and Zucht versus King in 1922. In Jacobson, you had a man suing the state of Massachusetts. Massachusetts fined him $5, five big dollars, for not being vaccinated against smallpox. He said, no, you can't do that. Went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Massachusetts. And then in 1922, you had Zucht versus King and San Antonio. And San Antonio City Ordinance was allowed to mandate vaccines for all private and public school students. After that case was decided at SCOTUS, Supreme Court of the United States. So let's talk about each one of these cases quickly and see what we think about that. Then we'll take a step back and look at what SCOTUS might do today. The Jacobson case first. So first thing, this Jacobson case, it was decided by John Marshall Harlan, which is interesting, right? John Roberts put up John Marshall Harlan's portrait in the chamber where the nine Supreme Court justices deliberate. At least that's what everybody says. And what a piece of signaling by Roberts right there. Anyway, Harlan has some great decisions to his credit and some great dissents. They call him the great dissenter, in fact, because Harlan was the guy who stood out about a decade earlier than this case in Massachusetts, this Jacobson case. A decade earlier, Harlan was the only dissenter in the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, right? The separate but unequal racist decision there. So Harlan gets a lot of credit for being the dissenter in that. Good job, Harlan. However, in 1905, much like Florida State at the end of the game, he blew it. Oh, sorry, Seminoles fans. Anyway, Harlan, here in 1905 in the Jacobson case, he wrote the majority opinion, and he decided that, of course, Massachusetts did have the authority to do this. Now, what are some differences between the Jacobson case and what's going on now? Again, in the Jacobson case, you had a man. He had had a bad experience with smallpox vaccine or with other similar injections before, and he did not want to have this vaccine. He sued the government, and it came down to a 14th Amendment case, protection, equal protection under the law, due process, claimed it violated his personal liberties. Well, there are some differences, important differences, between that case and what's going on with Biden's proposed vaccine mandate. First difference, there was a state law in Massachusetts in place authorizing Massachusetts to do this. Now, a state law is a very different beast than a federal regulation coming through OSHA and OSHA's Emergency Temporary Standards Code, which is supposedly the source for the federal government's authority on this. The code reads that OSHA can enact a rule like this if, quote, workers are in grave danger due to exposure to toxic substances or agents determined to be toxic or physically harmful or to new hazards. Now, OSHA has never mandated vaccines like this before, so the question does come up, if this language applies to pathogens like the SARS-CoV-2 virus, why hasn't OSHA really realized that before? And again, very different between existing state law and a federal regulation that hasn't been interpreted in this way before. Second difference, two more big differences here between Jacobson and the present situation. Second difference is that smallpox is very different from COVID, right? I mean, smallpox has about a 30% death rate. It kills equally everyone, every ages. You don't have to get into any sort of crazy utilitarian average value of a life or average life years lost, nothing like that. Smallpox hits across the board, 30% death rate. But of course, on the other hand, SARS-CoV-2 virus and COVID disease, you've got like maybe a 0.4% fatality rate, 0.2 infected fatality rate if you're not in an institution already. it really does not approach the virulence and the mortality that smallpox had wreaked across humanity for centuries. And of course, also in context, in 1905, the leading causes of death were infectious diseases. That is not at all the case now, right? We have heart disease, we have cancer in our top two spots, according to some people, right? The third leading cause of death is medical error. Probably not. There were some studies, and I respect the authors of those studies, and they have some good points, but I think there were some methodological flaws there. Still, I do think medical error is a big problem. It certainly is, actually. I'm not sure if third place on the list is, but the point is that infectious diseases are not, right? If it's not medical error, it's accidents, right? In a normal year, COVID notwithstanding. So that's a big difference between 1905 and 2021, the context, the milieu, if you will, in which this pandemic is playing out. And the third difference, and this is maybe the most important. Now, listen to the language from the great dissenter, Justice Harlan, on why he said it was okay for the state to do this. He says, and this is a quote, "In every well-ordered society charged with the duty of conserving the safety of its members, the rights of the individual in respect of his liberty may at times, under the pressure of great dangers, be subjected to such restraint to be enforced by reasonable regulations as the safety of the general public may demand." All right, now keep that in mind, and now listen to what our President, Mr. Joe Tornado Biden, said. They don't call him tornadoes anymore. Well, what Joe Biden said, go listen to that speech if you hadn't. Tornado Joe Biden here said in his speech, see if you can spot the key similarity. Here's a quote. "This is not about freedom or personal choice. It's about protecting yourself and those around you, the people you work with, the people you care about, the people you love. My job as president is to protect all Americans." Is it though? Do you hear the similarities? Now, both are assuming it is the government's job to protect Americans from viruses, from pathogens. Is it though? Certainly maybe from foreign actors, from armies, from violence, from aggression, from intentional assaults on your rights. Absolutely, this is why we institute governments among men, to maintain peace. But is a virus an act of violence? If it is, why isn't it the government's job to stop cancer? Why isn't it the government's job to stop heart disease? Stop all the problems, the health problems, health issues, the mortality, the morbidity linked to obesity. I mean, we know darn well how to stop a lot of those problems. Why isn't it the government's job to seize your Twinkie right out of your crumbly, yellow, stained fingers and say, no, 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 here's a stick of celery instead, right? I mean, that would be protecting your health. Is that the government's job? Is it the government's job to protect you from ill health? Is it your government's job to protect you from self-inflicted ill health? Remember, much, a great majority, perhaps, of the death from COVID is linked to comorbidities, and many of those comorbidities are, to some extent, self-inflicted from obesity, from lifestyle choices. So is it the government's job to protect you from those? Well, you look at the preamble to the Constitution, I don't see anything in there about Twinkies. I don't see anything in there saying, you can only have one mutton chop a day, so we do ordain and establish this Constitution. I don't see that in there, right? And anybody who tries to invoke the general welfare clause in this and interpret it as some government mandate for tyranny over public health, well, then you, my friend, you are a power-hungry, statist, necrotizing amoeba. That is not what the preamble says, and not what the founders had in mind. It definitely does that. But on another sense, who cares what the preamble says, right? We are in 2021. We just talked about differences in the world between the case a couple of centuries ago versus now. So ought it be the job to protect us against viruses, bacteria, cancer, prions, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease? Is it the government to say, hey, sponge brain, stop doing that? We've got to prevent you from doing that. Because, I mean, if it is the government's job to stop us from doing all this, first of all, they suck at it. All right. They're doing a really bad job of protecting us from this. And you know, could we sue them from that? Oh, no, no. They would say, come on, let's not get crazy. Let's stay serious, son. Yes, it's our job. It's our responsibility. We have the power to do it. But you can't hold us accountable for that. Come on now. Accountability is for the unelected. You know that. We all know that. All right. So I think clearly it is not the government's responsibility to protect us from certain pathogens, especially self-inflicted, self-elected even pathogens. Now, let's look at the Zucht versus King case. This is the second case that I was telling you about that people have been talking about in relation to COVID and the vaccine mandate that Biden proposes. So Zucht versus King, the San Antonio case where this young girl did not want to be vaccinated, but she claimed, again, under the 14th Amendment, due process, equal protection of the law, she claimed that this was violating her rights under the Constitution, and she had to be allowed to go to a school without being vaccinated. Again, this is Justice Brandeis. He sided against her, sided with the city ordinance of San Antonio, saying they did have the power to mandate vaccines for all public and private school attendees. Well, you know, if you go and you read this decision, well, first of all, let me say this. First of all, let me say this. Point out that this is a city ordinance again, right? This is a city ordinance, very different from a federal OSHA regulation with murky language that hasn't ever been interpreted in that way before. They're going to have to go not just to the penumbra, but the like fourth or fifth umbra, the adumbra of this of the OSHA regulations to find that interpretation. But more importantly, so that's the first thing. City ordinance, very different. But more importantly, if you read this Zucht versus King decision from 1922, it's only three paragraphs long. The entire decision is three paragraphs long, and it's basically just C. Jacobson. It's, in other words, it's really not a new decision. It's really just a decision that says, you know what, 17 years ago, we already decided this, and the Supreme Court said, yep, all good here, thumbs up. Local government, state, city, they can enact legislation that does this. In other words, I don't really know why everyone is so focused on Zucht versus King. It's really the same case as Jacobson. They just said, see Jacobson, and they washed their hands with it, and they moved on to cases that would take them maybe more than three paragraphs to issue a ruling on. All right, now let's step back and take a big picture. We are getting to other stuff in the news, I promise, but take a big step back, look at this other look at this vaccine mandate decision. Two more things, two final thoughts to leave you with. First, what has the influence of this Jacobson decision been? Well, we saw that with Zucht, that was one influence, right? Another in Buck versus Bell, Oliver Wendell Holmes in 1927, this decision was the famous decision. And he invoked James Jacobson in this decision. This decision gave the okay to forcible sterilization of what the decision called the feeble-minded. Now, here's a quote from that 1927 decision. See how you like the language in this. It says, the principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. Okay, now don't at me. That was a quote from this 1927 decision. So you have to ask yourself, is this the type of legal precedent we think is good to keep around? Is this what Jacobson, if it's leading to language like this, is this really what we want? Maybe we should think about overturning it. And also, if you look at the Jacobson decision, you read it, Justice Harlan, the great dissenter, he cited in his decision about this, he said, well, you know what? It's okay. You know what's good for the government to do, what's fine for the government to do, is the draft, the military draft. We can draft people, we can send them to military service and basically sentence them to have a pretty high chance of dying in warfare. So mandatory vaccination, it must be a lot better than the draft, and so it's definitely okay. Are we really okay with the draft at this point in 2021? We haven't used the draft in 50 years. Would people really be okay with the draft now? I'm not so sure that they would, but I do have to say, actually, unfortunately, in my opinion, whenever I've surveyed my students on this, and I do about once a year, I do a little anonymous survey on what they think. And one of the questions I usually ask them about is the draft. And most of them just take it for granted. And they say, yeah. And they say that we should expand the draft to women, too, because, you know, equality. Reasons of equality. Yeah, if we're doing something really bad to half the population, it makes a lot of sense to do it really bad to the other half of the population too. That's great. Good reasoning. Okay, so that's the first thing. The influence of Jacobson really has not been great. It informed some really bad Supreme Court decisions subsequent to Jacobson, established a poor precedent. Now let's think about what has changed since then. Nicholas Tampio in the Boston Globe has given you an excellent summary. Basically, the rights revolution happened. The rights revolution of the 20th century, respect for your bodily integrity under the 14th Amendment. The most famous case of this is Roe versus Wade in 1973, My Body, My Choice. But of course, that rested on the Griswold decision that allowed people the right to use contraceptives. That was in 1965. You had in 1987, no experimental therapy or drugs could be allowed into your body, even if you are in the military, without your consent. In 1990, we had the ruling that said that you could refuse medical treatment that would save your life. Even if it would save your life, you can refuse medical treatment. So a lot has changed. A lot has transpired since this 1905 Jacobson decision. We've certainly cast a bunch of other decisions from right around 1905, Lochner, and I think we need to discard Jacobson at this point. We will see. How do I think the Supreme Court would go on this? Well, I'm sure that Roberts and Sotomayor and Kagan and Breyer would want to uphold Jacobson. So would the other five be in favor of overturning it? I think there's a good chance they would, and I think you might get a classic Neil Gorsuch opinion issued here. We will see. We will see if the big G comes through for us. All right, let's go on to other things in the news right now. China. Ooh, boy, China has basically banned all new video games. They stopped issuing licenses for new video games. The government there says that this is to fight gaming addiction in the under 18 population. China's just issuing all kinds of crackdowns. I don't know. Maybe they looked around and they're like, red ribbon, second place, good enough. Okay, let's just put the clamps on now. We've allowed capitalism to bring us up into this second place position. And now it's time to start reining things in. Of course, they don't want to rein in their population. They're trying to increase their population, or at least their birth rate again. They're worried about the birth rate declining. Maybe making life bad for kids. I don't know if that's going to accomplish that goal. China had already, in addition to this ban on video games, already recently, China had said that kids under 18, minors, can only play video games now for, you want to guess how many hours per week the Chinese Communist Party, the socialists in China, are allowing their under 18 citizens to play video games? You want to guess if you don't know? 3 hours per week. And not only that, they tell you when those 3 hours are. If you're under 18 in China, here are the times when you can legally play video games. 8 to 9 p.m. Friday, 8 to 9 p.m. Saturday, 8 to 9 p.m. Sunday. Other than that, no video games for you if you're under 18 in China. Wow. This is pretty amazing. Now, I will point out they did stop issuing licenses for new video games once before in 2018 for about 9 months. They stopped doing this. Of course, during that time, Tencent's this huge gaming company over there. The two biggest game companies over there, Tencent, which does League of Legends, right? Tencent bought a majority share. They got it from Riot. a while ago now. And Tencent lost about $200 billion in 2018 off its value during those 9 months. So far, since this ruling last week, or this, I guess you can call it a ruling from the Communist Party, Tencent has lost about $80 billion, which is about 10% of its value. Is Tencent mad? I mean, the naive response would be, of course, but if you think about it, maybe not too mad, because maybe they're thinking in the long run, they will recoup their value that was lost as everybody sold off their stock last week, panicking. And because, you know, this is classical rent seeking, Tencent can make tons of money, and they do make tons of money, selling new skins in League of Legends. They can sell new champs in League of Legends. They can sell variations on League of Legends, like Teamfight Tactics. I don't know if Legends of Runeterra would be considered a separate video game under the CCP ruling or not, but this is sort of a classic rent-seeking maneuver to keep the competition away and pretty much hand Tencent and NetEase almost control over the market. Can't say monopoly, I guess, since there are two of them. NetEase, by the way, does a couple of games. The biggest games known to the Western audience, right, would be NetEase is the licensee, or they have the power to distribute or license or sell in China Minecraft. And of course, also all the Blizzard games like Warcraft and Overwatch and Starcraft for you Brood War fans like me. Huh. Well, what is going to become of this? Well, one of the first consequences, obviously, is that now there's this great black market online. All kinds of shops online that are renting counterfeited age accounts to minors to let them bypass the new rule, right? Kids are going online, they're getting an account that says, oh, I'm really 23, and that allows them to play video games other than the 3 prescribed hours during the week. I don't know. I don't think that prohibition worked out too well in this country. I don't think that video game prohibition is going to work out too well in the Chinese country. Certainly, as a parent, I want my child to play more than 3 hours of video games a week and to be able to play them on hours that aren't necessarily these 3 prescribed hours. I've bonded with my kids a lot over video games. By the way, if you're looking to do the same, I recommend Elder Scrolls Online. I successfully and joyfully have played Elder Scrolls Online with my kids starting from the age of 4. That's right. I mean, you can maybe then say that Elder Scrolls Online is just a face-mashing game. You know, wrap your head in bubble wrap, roll it across the keyboard, and you're going to have success if a 4-year-old can play it. Now, I love my kids, and I have to think they're pretty darn capable for being only 4 years old. It's true. You know, you could say Elder Scrolls Online, a bit easier game. League of Legends, of course, you can't do that too much unless you're playing the bots and you're relying on your teammates. Video games, if you're not using those as a parenting tool and as a family bonding tool, then you're kind of stuck in the 20th century. Go out and play some games with your kids already. Gosh darn it. China, though, you know, obviously CCP, they're not too big on parents bonding with their kids. They want the kids to bond with the socialists, to bond with the state, to bond with the Communist Party itself. So they're cracking down on all kinds of stuff, right? They're cracking down on gay love in games. They call it boys' love, sissy, and effeminate males. Well, you know, Chinese Communist Party, you haven't banned League of Legends outright yet, just new games. If you're going to ban, you know, effeminate males, ooh, CCP, have you even looked at League of Legends and some of the most recent champions there? Akshan, Viego, Aphelios. That's pretty much exactly what you're campaigning against. And it's one of the most popular games out there. This is going to kill the Chinese professional gaming development program too. Although I wonder, I bet they're going to make exceptions for pro players and players in pro development, right? Esports are going to come to the next Asian Games, and I don't think China wants to be left out of that. I bet they're going to make an exception to this rule for professionals. So once again, creating two different classes. That's what socialism always does. The elite, who have their own rules, and the rest of us. Oh, China. Yeah, no longer the Middle Kingdom. Definitely the Middle Finger Kingdom. That's right, I said it. Next item in the news, Megan Fox and Machine Gun Kelly on the VMAs. Machine Gun Kelly, I would wear that suit, man. He wore this red glitter suit. That was awesome. But Megan Fox, oh my goodness, did you see her dress? And I use that term dress only in the vaguest existential sense, right? You remember that old Stephen Wright joke about his high school? Stephen Wright would say, now in my high school, our school colors were clear. We used to say, I'm not naked, I'm in the band. Well, last night, folks, Megan Fox was in the band in Brooklyn. Her dress was clear. She basically just wore a G-string with clear over it. I don't even want to call it a dress. Well played, Megan Fox. Well played. You certainly got some attention from the ADK homeroom. Brian Austin Green, eat your heart out. Also, Machine Gun Kelly and Conor McGregor coming to blows on the red carpet. So the publicity machine in full mode, full send yesterday for Megan and her beau, Machine Gun Kelly. Not sure what the blows were about. I couldn't find that. So maybe we'll have to revisit that tomorrow. Next item in the news, speaking of aliens, by the way, Robin Hanson had this amazing paper come out about Robin Hanson of Overcoming Bias. His paper was about aliens, grabby aliens in particular, some conclusions that we can make about alien civilizations. That's so huge, though. We're not going to have time to get into that. Yeah, we'll get to that tomorrow. But I said speaking of aliens, of course, because Megan's dress, right, was a Thierry Mugler dress. And Thierry Mugler was famous for his alien designs. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, sometime like that. Next time in the news, running a little long in the news here today, folks, we'll try to zoom through here. U.S. declassified a bunch of 9/11 documents. The first one making the news relates to the Saudi government and basically says, yes, there were officials in the Saudi government that helped the 9/11 hijackers. Oof, I'm just ticking off all the evil foreign governments today, aren't I? In particular, the Saudi diplomat Fahd Al-Tumeri, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right. I was maybe 50% correct with Thierry Mugler, but now I'm probably 0% right with this one. This Saudi diplomat, he was basically ordering friends of his in Los Angeles to give aid to two hijackers. He apparently knew about the attack a year in advance, this Saudi diplomat, and he had a position with the Saudi government. He told a year before the attacks, he told his friend that these are two very important people. You have to help them out, blah, 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 blah. A different Saudi government employee met the hijackers in a restaurant and previously released like the 2004 commission report and said, oh, that was just a coincidence. Yeah, sure, right. As the knights of the dinner table would say, sure, right. But now this new report, the Encore report that was just unveiled, published in 2016 after a long, years-long investigation, says no, not coincidence, not by chance. So then, of course, the question becomes, well, how many people? Certainly some people now, it's clear, in the Saudi government knew that this attack was coming. How many people did the king know? Did MBS know? MBS still quite young back then, of course. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to find out. Certainly what happened with Khashoggi and going all the way up to MBS. MBS definitely knew about the assassination hit on Khashoggi, the American Saudi journalist in Turkey. The Saudi government at the highest levels absolutely authorized that kill. But how high did the knowledge of these attacks go? We're not sure yet. All right. Now, we try to end the news segment every day on some good news. Here's your good news for today. MIT down there on the Charles River in Boston, racking up another score. Gotta love MIT. 20 Tesla magnet developed down there. Most powerful of its kind. If you're wondering by comparison, Earth's magnetic field that makes a little compass needle swing around and a line pointing towards the magnetic North Pole, which of course is not the same as the geographic North Pole, that Earth's magnetic field is about 30 microtesla. That is about 30 times 10 to the negative 6 Tesla. Tesla, of course, the good unit of magnetic field strength. So 20 Tesla, that's almost right, a million times more, a million times stronger. Haha, there's our theme from the slogan again. A million times stronger than the Earth's magnetic field. Now, why is this so important? Because it could possibly contain a fusion reaction. This holy grail of nuclear engineering that has been around for almost 100 years now, we'd like to contain a fusion reaction. We can do fusion bombs, we can do fission bombs, and we can contain a fission reaction in a nuclear power plant, and we can use the fission power plant to generate electricity, right? You just use the heat from the nuclear reaction to boil the water. Water is steam, turns the turbine, and turns the armature inside a magnetic field that creates electricity by Maxwell's laws. Well, we would love to use fusion to do the same thing, because fusion doesn't have the toxic byproducts that fission does, and doesn't require uranium like fission does and mining like fission does. Although, if you remember our discussion from last week, Oklo, the natural nuclear fission reactor, there was one. Go back and listen to that episode. There was a natural nuclear reactor about 2 billion years ago, and the toxic byproducts from it have moved like a couple centimeters in 1.8 billion years. So, you know, if you find the right spot, and it doesn't seem too hard to find, you could keep these byproducts, these toxic byproducts from a fission reactor contained. There's really no reason on that account not to be switching over to fission power, especially in light of the fears of over climate change and greenhouse gases and carbon emissions. But fusion would be even better than fission, be even cleaner. There would still be haters. You know, people just hate power. They don't want people to have power. Fusion would be great for that. And the people at MIT are now claiming that this was their last technical hurdle before their Spark reactor, slated for 2025, is able to work. And Spark is supposed to actually be efficient and effective, cost effective at generating electricity. In other words, it will generate more electricity, more valuable electricity, more valuable energy out than you have to put in. So this is great for MIT. Love MIT down there. Super cool place. So let's hope that this comes through. Now we're a little behind schedule. I guess I got so caught up in all of that vaccine mandate stuff. Wanted to give you guys the full story and really clue you in on that. But let's go into our topic now for our second half. We've been talking about longevity. We've been talking about things that are unseen and benefits that could accrue to us if only we work towards them. Some people are so caught up in the status quo that they fail to see how great the world could be if only they stepped outside the status quo. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of inertia. There's a lot of lack of vision that prevents the advancement of society. You know, William F. Buckley Jr. founded National Review, and when he founded it, he said that the magazine wanted to stand athwart history, yelling, "Stop!" That was sort of his conservative position there. Well, my vision for this podcast is that we stand at history's back, yelling faster, faster. And in the interest of serving that goal, I want people to be able to see what is possible. I think some people have no idea what's out there. So again, following up with our Bastiat dictum or idea or teaching to see what is unseen. So the big four, right, the big four prizes that civilization's after here, right, is artificial intelligence, immortality, actually effective interplanetary and or interstellar space travel, and extraterrestrial intelligence. Those are the big four, and any of those would be life-changing, planet-changing, civilization-changing, and they have the potential to be great. Certainly potential to not be great, too. Got to be careful. Let's talk today, though, about immortality and longevity. Now, I had a great former student from Stanford email me the other day, and she said, there are two things I just wanted to share with you. Number one, all I ever needed to know for chemistry, I learned in your eighth grade class. That obviously, that warmed the cockles of my heart, right? That's so awesome for any teacher to hear. And the second thing she said was, back in the day, I thought you were crazy when you used to tell us that old age is a disease. But now I think you're right. Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, that also warms the cockles of the heart, right? And it's true. Old age is a disease. People don't even think about that. They just take it as this fact of life that is unchangeable. It's metaphysically given an immutable fact, but it's not immutable. We can change it. We can remake the aging landscape. And I would say we need to cure it. The first thing I always hear from people when I say this is they say, what? You want people to like live forever, or at least a few centuries at full youth and ripped John Cena-ness? That's a terrible idea because we'll have overpopulation. Everybody will starve to death. We'll run out of food. No, guys. That does not happen. It doesn't happen that people all of a sudden just look around and say, oh my goodness, we had too many babies. Now we don't have enough apples, enough potatoes, and we're all going to die now. We had too many babies. That doesn't happen. Just go to the Wikipedia list of famines, right? This Wikipedia article is called List of Famines, and read through it. You will not see overpopulation as a result. There's always a reason, a proximal reason, and it is almost always some climate disaster. Could be some disease that comes through, right? It could be a war. These are your causes. It's not that all of a sudden people just wake up and are like, oh, I had six kids and I should have only had one. That is not it. There is a reason, like war, right? I could go through these, right? 2011, 2012, famine in Somalia, brought on by the East African drought. 2016, famine in Yemen, brought on by the Yemeni civil war. 2017, South Sudan, Nigeria, brought on by a drought. These are climate change. Back in the night, some famous ones, right? Back in the 90s, you had the North Korean famine. Was that overpopulation? Well, let me tell you, South Korea has like double the population, really just about double, 50 million versus 25 million, population of North Korea. So it's not overpopulation that is the problem in North Korea. It was government policy. Sometimes they do it on purpose, right? Like the Holodomor inflicted by Stalin on the Ukrainians in the early 1930s. 1975, 1979, Cambodia, Khmer Rouge, 500,000 Cambodian lives lost to famine. Not because all of a sudden they just had too many children. It was a cause, a man-made cause. In that case, the government basically attacked its own citizens. You go back to the famous Bangladesh famine in 1974. Well, the Bangladeshi War for Independence, basically from Pakistan, East Pakistan, in 1972, had just concluded, and they had horrific floods that year, and then they had a completely misguided government response with rationing and price controls after that. So it's not overpopulation, folks, that causes famines, and it hasn't been. So what are you looking at then as an objection to immortality, right? Are you talking about boredom? Well, Heinlein already covered that in Time Enough for Love, right? Spoiler alert, there are ways around that. We won't go into those. Perhaps on this show, I certainly have a lot more latitude on this show than I did in the classroom, but I'm not quite ready. It's still early in the morning to discuss the particular ways around that Mr. Long found in Time Enough for Love. Lazarus Long, what a character. So, but maybe you're, maybe then if it's not boredom that you're objecting to immortality for, or longevity, extreme longevity for, maybe it's pain, right? The accumulated thousand shocks that mortal flesh is heir to. Just wearing you down. I'm wearing you down, Laura. Right, you probably hadn't expected to hear both Shakespeare and Urkel quoted in the same sentence, but you never know what you're going to get in the ADK homeroom. Anyway, life is so good now that I think people are willing to overlook those thousand shocks, or those thousand shocks aren't so shocky as they used to anymore, right? We have Tylenol. We have conquered pain in a lot of cases, and not in every case, right? I have a friend who had to retire from teaching at age 34 because of untreated scoliosis, and she has basically been in excruciating back pain every single day of her life since then. Pain is real. I'm not saying that people don't still suffer from pain, but by and large, most people do not have that kind of pain. We are free from the toothaches. We are free from these crippling, many of these crippling conditions that made life not worth it so much up until really just recent decades. We've remade the world to our liking, right? We have air conditioning. We have Netflix on demand, so people don't even object to these shut-in orders to some extent. We have roads and plumbing, analgesics. We're terraforming the earth for our AI successors with the internet, right? That's what the internet is. It's just terraforming the earth for our artificial intelligence successors. Don't let them fool you otherwise. But it's still pretty awesome to have the entire world's knowledge in your pocket in a phone. So we've got a pretty nice place to spend eternity now. And maybe that's why people are finally waking up to this idea that, oh yeah, maybe old age is a problem. Maybe we could change something about this. Maybe this awesome life that we're having with our Netflix and our cheeseburgers and our kids, that we don't have to suffer through having a 50% chance of dying before age 5, as they did just a century or two ago. Maybe this world is worth sticking around in. I kind of like this world, right? So that's what's changed, and that's why people are sort of taking longevity seriously now. How are we doing? Well, not good enough, in my opinion, right? As people have been listening to me since the 80s, then maybe we would be a lot farther along here. But we're starting, right? We are starting. 2013 California Life Company, better known as Calico, founded by Bill Maris with Google's backing out there. They're trying to stop aging. 2008, Max Planck Institute for the Biology of Aging over there in Germany, getting work done. Son, I need to look up how to say hashtag work in German. That's interesting. All right. So AgeX Therapeutics, founded in 2017 here in America, in Silico Medicine in 2014 in Hong Kong. Hope you guys are hanging in down there. So we are starting to get there. Now, what causes aging? I mean, there's a lot of things. This is a syndrome. This is many things together, many causes, and a lot of the causes are still murky because, like I said, people haven't been treating old age as a disease. But now we're starting to, and you got multiple things, right? DNA damage just accumulates, right? Leo Szilard, the physicist, he was one of the first on the train arguing for this theory. You've got free radicals moving around, molecules or ions looking to react. They wander around your system. They cause damage. There's just the wear and tear, accumulated damage over a long time. You have telomeres, right? These are the little pieces of information that protect the chromosomes. They're on the end of the chromosomes, and they protect the chromosomes from damage, but the telomeres get worn down as the cells split and the cells age. Another problem, of course, is that senescent cells tend to stay around after dying. They don't just, you know, snap, disappear, dust away like a vampire in Buffy. The senescent cells, they hang around too long, like that third wheel when you're over at somebody's house in high school, and you just, anyway. So yes, what technologies are out there? We are running short on time, so I'm just going to give you one right now. We will pick it up again tomorrow and talk about this more tomorrow. But one drug in use right now, it's in phase 3 trials right now, very exciting, is metformin. This started its pharmaceutical life as a diabetes drug decades ago. But now you have this gentleman, Nir Barzilai. That's a cool name. Nir Barzilai. He's an MD. He's the director of the National Institute of Health's Nathan Schock Centers of Excellence in the Basic Biology of Aging. Well, you know, I'm glad he's up in the Centers of Excellence now. Maybe this guy started his career in the Nathan Schock Centers of Putridity. That would be bad. I'm glad we don't really put a lot of funding into the Centers of Putridity. Good thing we have the Centers of Excellence. Anyway, so this National Institute Center is near Barzilai. He's a professor down at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in the Bronx. And he's leading a study on metformin and trying to prove that aging is a preventable health condition. The study, if you want to look it up, is called TAME, Targeting Aging with Metformin. TAME is a great name. I'm not in general favor of acronyms, and really I'm not here either. But if you're going to have an acronym, TAME at least has a double meaning here. So TAME, the study is designed to check out to see if metformin can be this sort of anti-aging wonder drug. It's in phase three. It has, I think, 14 different sites all around the country. And at these 14 sites, which are like Yale University and Wake Forest, University of Florida, Northwestern. Northwestern seems to be coming up everywhere these days. What they're doing there, they have 3,000 individuals enrolled in the study, ages 65 to 79. And they are doing testing to see if metformin will hold up, because initial indications are good, my friends. They are really good. People notice, the reason they're doing the study is because people notice that the folks who have been taking metformin for type 2 diabetes have lower death rates from any cause. All-cause death, just flat out lower for people who have been taking metformin compared to peers who don't take the drug. It curbs all kinds of things. We're talking heart disease. We're talking Alzheimer's, dementia. Tremendous, tremendous possibilities for this drug. It may even lower, according to the TAME website, which of course is going to be self-lionizing to some extent, but they're talking about lower the risk from types of cancer as well. Even now, you know, the TAME website is updated in COVID-19. People who have contracted COVID-19, been victims of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, if they're taking metformin, they're less likely than their peers to die of COVID also. So this is pretty awesome. One thing that is unfortunate about metformin, which might act against its approval, is that it's not quite clear how it works. Its mechanism is a little bit hard to fathom. Reminds me a little bit about aspirin. For a long time, people used to say that if aspirin were discovered in the 1970s, it would never win approval because it was impenetrable almost how its exact workings were going on and all the effects and side effects it had on the body. Last note on metformin, though, that's interesting. It's originally derived from Galega officinalis, which is goat's rue. And goat's rue, anybody who plays Dungeons and Dragons, or anybody who got the Cant and Crew from Gary Gygax, that was Gary Gygax's last great book, by the way, R.I.P. Gary Gygax. His masterpiece is the first edition Dungeon Master's Guide, if you're looking to read his masterpiece. But his last great book was the Cant and Crew, and goat's rue is in there. It's a medicine. It's a known herb, right, that since medieval times, the witches, the wise women, and the barbers, I guess, maybe that's a little bit after the medieval times, have been using goat's rue as a medicinal herb. Well, that's going to need a cardboard tube in the middle of it because it's a wrap. That is our saran wrap, our aluminum wrap on the day, folks. And we will be back at it again tomorrow discussing longevity, discussing Robin Hanson's aliens. Today, of course, we talked about the vaccine mandate that Biden put up. We talked about these two Supreme Court cases, Jacobson and Zook versus King, that everybody is citing as justification, perhaps, for Biden and his mandate. I tried to show you how there are some very important differences between those cases and what's going on now. And of course, we also talked about, should it really even be the government's job to protect against the environment and sometimes even self-selected, self-chosen pathogens, or at least conditions. We talked about China and the video game industry, Megan Fox's dress, and Machine Gun Kelly's little dust up there, declassified documents in the 9/11 thing. We talked about fusion. I'm sorry to do that to you. I know fusion's been on the horizon for forever, but maybe this time it's finally getting close. And then, of course, we ended the day with longevity and trying to get people to see what is possible, what actually could happen if you throw off the shackles of inertia, the status quo, and the fear and the needing U.S. Federal Food and Drug Administration to approve every little thing that delays things by decades, trying to get people to see what is unseen, how great things could be if we only choose to go out there and take them. I will see you tomorrow, folks. Take care.